I... Rogan giggled again, but quickly gained control over the involuntary action. I watched you come in. Watched you all come in.
Gus straightened. Watched us all come in. You do anything to the people with me? Because if you did...
Rogan raised one arm in an odd jerk as if a marionette was manipulating the limb. They're on the lower fifth, he said, looking for the hidden evacuation route.
How do you know that?
The edges of that shadowed face hitched in a smile, the lower jaw still shivering. Been watching them too. Watching everyone. Months of nothing, and suddenly everything's on TV.
Rogan cackled then, and he allowed that ghastly laughter to fill the room.
Been watching you in particular. You're very brave. Or suicidal.
Gus didn't respond to that, but he did shuffle his feet, stirring up all that plastic underfoot.
You've brought the barbarian hordes, Rogan said, to the gates of the kingdom. I never thought I'd see people again. Never, never. Let alone...
He lifted an arm, pointing a finger. Gus looked over his shoulder at the computer screens. The mindless, plowing through a corridor, pawing at doors, at walls. Arms waved madly, shaking broken hands and fingers, destroying, polluting the charm of each sector in the compound. They slammed the screens of woodland wonders. They knocked over trees and trampled through greenery. They smashed into the wall displays, breaking scenes of seaside delights, shattering the careful illusions of Whitecap. There was no thought to their search, no reason, just the maddening attraction to the residual stink clinging to Gus's armored ass.
They're searching for you, Rogan explained, his jawline quivering. Only you. I watched you shoot them with the automatic weapons. I bet that was fun.
Gus frowned.
No?
Rogan asked. He quickly changed the subject.
When you climbed into the ductwork, you surprised me. Surprised me even more when you pulled out that dead tech. I knew that man. To see him. I think his name was...
Rogan's shoulders trembled.
Chris!
He blurted with a wild, lingering chuckle, stopping only when Rogan realized Gus didn't join in.
Sorry, Rogan apologized, suddenly serious. That wasn't as funny as I thought it was.
No, it wasn't.
In any case, the zombies, they're following you, by scent, by smell. I mean, you smell badly.
Sorry, Gus said. Guess I'm in the right spot. How about you give me one of your no-stink sticks?
Certainly.
Gus didn't go for one, however. So you've been waiting here, leading me along?
Rogan's trembling eased, just a bit. I've been waiting for someone to come along, anyone to come along. I've been waiting to turn over this, all of this, to what's been left over. I've been waiting for you, I think, and your companions.
Gus wasn't sure he understood. What? He finally got out.
Rogan fidgeted in his wheelchair. We've had terrible things happen here. Terrible things. I was the only one left alive. I was with the security team when the breakout happened and the virus spread like a fire.
Gus listened as a growing horror crept through his frayed nerves.
The virus, Rogan explained. There are degrees to the virus. Waves. Yes. Waves. There was the first outbreak, like a mushroom cloud, so to speak. Those you disposed of by shooting in the head. The only way. The cinematic way. But then what we later learned was that there was an unnoticed second outbreak. If a zombie was shot in the head, there was a chance that the corpse, during its decomposition, would spore. That the virus would pollinate the air in a last-ditch effort to survive its dead host. Only a small percentage of the corpses, but if you were anywhere near that 5% before an air current could disperse it and you breathed the spore in,
Gus could only stare, and in that stretching silence he whispered, "What?"
"A second wave of undead, driven to spread the virus through bloody contact just like the first. But if you were wounded or bitten, it would take control of a person much faster, within seconds."
"Seconds?" Rogan cocked his head. "That's the trouble with weaponized strains, with the splicing and the mixing. There are so many levels to testing, so many variables to consider, and so many unknowns. You never really know the final outcome. Not without the proper protective measures, the proper control groups. When we got word that the first virus escaped, that was the beginning of the end. Why we came to Whitecap in the first place, to wait it all out. We even developed the TI serum just in case, formulating it on what we knew about the initial strain, but even that was a mistake."
Gus thought of Wallace. "Some people changed."
"Some changed indeed," Rogan giggled, then grew serious. "We hoped the serum would immunize, and it did, but it also mutated a percentage. In all honesty, the TI serum was rushed, a frantic solution that we hoped would protect our people against that first terrible strain. There were no control groups, only subjects. There was no choice in the matter. Not for active military personnel. We were told, were ordered, to tell them anything. Tell them it's a cure, but report, record, everything. Through authorized channels. Take further samples if and when necessary. So, they received the first doses because they were going out there, you understand? Outside. They needed something to protect them. They were the first test group."
Computers continued to whisper in the background, filling the silence between the two men.
"I knew one," Gus said. "A soldier from here. A special soldier. He was turning into a zombie, but he still talked like a guy. Until the end."
"He retained his identity?"
"While I knew him."
"Fascinating."
Rogan's jawline began to twitter.
"He was an exception. One of Whitecap's soldiers infected the whole bunker. That's what happened here. He'd been injected with TI, then one day, while posted in the med lab, he went full-on zombie. Went from a person to zombie in a heartbeat. He bit a nurse, who bit a doctor, who bit a waiting patient. One bit one, and they became two. Two infected two more. Four infected four more, and so on. From there, it was a frenzy.
Carnage."
Rogan's teeth chattered.
"Less than a day. A day. 90% of the populace had been turned. The security team I was with. There was a fight.
We lost," he chuckled. "We didn't want the infected getting out. Couldn't let anyone in. Some of the soldiers set explosive charges, blew the entrance to prevent anyone from entering. That worked. There were still zombies running around, some even spored, which infected the remainder of the soldiers. 2 days later, I was the only one left. Secured myself in the upper levels, here, in security command. Watched the undead roam the corridors. I watched the madness. I saw the PM walking about the lower floors with his family, hunting for survivors. It was horrible. Horrible."
Gus took a deep breath, trying to forget his own experiences with the undead. He knew about horror. He knew about it very well.
"Then someone came knocking," Rogan said with a giggle. "Or rather, digging. I watched." He pointed at the screens. "Watched it all as the knocking, the digging, the grinding drew the remainder of the zombies to the main entrance. Everyone that could walk. Then the door was opened, like a plug in a bathtub. They all flowed out in a gush. Then the fighting started. I couldn't see. The cameras on the outside didn't work for me. I couldn't get them to work. They were broken. Or I didn't know the codes, so I waited for whoever, when the door was opened. Except no one came. And I was left alone, again. Except Whitecap was clear of its zombies. This
All of this is a paradise compared to what's out there. And I've been waiting, hoping someone worthy would come before I die, to tell them what happened and what might happen from here on out. That got Gus's attention. What might happen? While the zombies roamed Whitecap, I noticed some retained their vigor more so than others. Those same zombies, when sustenance grew sparse, they would devour any of their dead cousins. The very thought screwed up Gus's face. Then he remembered. Those zombies, he asked. Could they die like regular people? Like being shot in the chest as well as the head? Rogan thought about it.
I never noticed.
Did you?
I did.
Interesting. In truth, the spore zombies aren't truly dead. I've seen them void themselves. They're just infected. Perhaps your zombies were produced by inhaling spore, or they were bitten or wounded by spore zombies. Gus thought of the masked douchebags and their weaponized mindless. Maybe.
Those were my thoughts, Rogan added, behind the ones that seemed to retain their speed for a longer period of time. In any case, while the virus is certainly running out of material, it's still out there. It might very well be out there for a while yet. Until all are destroyed, or decompose into nothing. In any case, spore or not, they're still zombies, and you let a considerable pack into the kingdom.
Gus's helmet seemed to tighten around his skull. Yeah, guess I did. Sorry about that.
Who are those people?
They're with me, Gus answered. We were running from a bunch of crazies who might be using zombies as shock troops.
That silenced Rogan. His jawline resumed its quivering.
That is disturbing.
Gus nodded that it most certainly was.
But I didn't mean those people on level 5, Rogan pointed out. I know they're with you. I meant them.
He pointed to the computer monitors. 41. One of the great mysteries after the fall of civilization was where the government went after fleeing the collapsing capital. Most believed the prime minister would be whisked away to a secret bunker deep under the earth. There he would hunker down and wait out the end of the virus with his family, supporting staff, and a few selected friends. During his isolation, the PM would plan for his return with whatever security forces remaining in order to reestablish law, order, and government. There were plenty of such bunkers south of the border, owned by governments and megacorporations, but accessing them was a challenge. First, a person had to know the location of the installation, as such information would be classified. Then there was the understanding that the bunkers were heavily fortified topside, with all manner of defensive measures in place to deter unauthorized individuals. Those measures included armed forces with orders to shoot trespassers on sight. Even if an intruder could sidestep the security considerations, they still had to bypass the main doors, sealed up and built to withstand nuclear blasts. Finding and accessing a bunker south of the border was out of the question, however, since the radiation belt after the reactor meltdowns prevented individuals from either country from crossing over. So, when the Vulture walked through the main doors of what was obviously an extensive installation, his mind was whirling with possibilities. Who might be inside? What was inside? And were there weapons? Initially, the Vulture didn't expect anyone to be inside the bunker since the doors were wide open. The leather had passed a veritable field of withered dead, hundreds of corpses leading up to the cavern entrance and within. None of those bodies had belonged to the leather, however, and that lifted the Vulture's hopes even more. The mindless that had been cut down on the bunker's threshold had been shot, however, by guns, perhaps a lot of guns, which meant ammunition. The Vulture wanted weapons, automatic weapons, military grade, and the ammunition to go with it, commodities that had all been savagely used up. It all meant power.
Dozens of the leather swarmed forward into the enormous garage, their crossbows raised and ready. They stepped over the fallen carcasses of the recently shot mindless, threading their way to open concrete. The vulture wandered in behind them with a handful of his own personal guard. Military guns and ammo would be a prize. The vulture would take any other supplies in the absence of weapons, but for now he wanted the weapons. He wanted the death from above. The size and scope of the garage impressed him, and he wondered just how big the bunker was. The outer defenses had taken considerable damage, and the main doors were obviously open for a reason, but otherwise the bunker's innards appeared fully functional. There were lights. Lights meant power. Power meant a source, just waiting to be discovered and accessed, and the leather had minions capable of carrying out repairs if needed. Under the ceiling's fragmented lighting system, which resembled great glaring saucers, the vulture slowed to a stop. His personal guard of a dozen or so stopped as well. The vulture inspected the nearby building, a security bunker within a bunker. He then studied the abandoned vehicles scattered throughout the vast parking area. Trucks, sedans, even a pair of backhoes. And God Almighty, a limousine. In the shadows, the vehicle resembled a sleek black automotive shark. The vulture shifted ever so slightly, exchanging neutral glances with the bronze, but they both knew what the other thought. The dog tongue would be pleased. Even if they didn't find any weapons or supplies, the bunker itself was a prize. It was an honest-to-God secret base, with its doors wide open, a platform to prepare and launch more strikes into the new world. The thought of others knowing about this base troubled the vulture, however. Several of the mindless had been cut down in the enormous corridor leading to the garage. The living dead had cornered survivors in the security booth, evident by the bloody prints still on the laminated glass. A vicious patchwork of skin fragments and hair stuck to the surface, indicating that whatever had been inside that mini bunker had greatly agitated the mindless. That mess practically covered the entire length of the glass. The leather set up a perimeter around the checkpoint, their loaded crossbows aimed outwards. Some of them used the little carts as cover, while a handful inspected one cart left in the middle of the lane. The vulture ignored his minions' maneuverings. He marched over to the security post and halted when a leather held up the first of three discarded battle rifles. Styx was stamped on the shoulder stock, along with Belgium made and a string of serial numbers. The vulture took the offered rifle and studied it. He placed it against his shoulder and looked down the sights. He turned toward his personal guard and aimed at his accompanying meat puppet, who was on his knees. The meat grew still, very much aware of the weapon. This particular puppet, the one who had called himself Top Gun, had done well killing one of the escaping islanders, and the vulture had rewarded the man by not stashing him back into the trunk of a car. He still wore the mask and gag, but after making the kill shot, the vulture decided to take him along. A nearby lesser held the meat puppet's rifle just in case it was needed again. Despite the meat puppet's obedience and obvious worth to the cause, he was still a meat puppet. The vulture squeezed the trigger with an audible click. The meat puppet tensed, his eyes blinking behind his mask. The vulture handed the weapon over to an underling and took a second weapon. He shouldered it and aimed again, right at the prisoner's head. Click. The meat puppet slumped in relief. The vulture handed that weapon over, his fingers wiggling for the third. When he got the last gun, he noticed the full magazine on top. He took aim again. The meat puppet slowly shook his head, not believing how his day was going. The vulture stared down the sights, and at the last second, fired a raging blast over the head of the prisoner. The meat puppet flinched, grabbing his head right where it was supposed to be. Muffled chuckles erupted from the nearby leather watching the scene. The meat puppet lowered his shaking hands and nodded, appreciating the joke for what it was. The vulture did not hand over the weapon. He turned away from the cowering slave and approached the security checkpoint, a long booth soiled by the touch of the mindless. The booth's door was locked, and the vulture noted a security keypad nearby. He studied the screen for a moment before pressing a thumb on an important-looking button. Nothing happened until a voice said, "Please enter your authorization code now." The vulture ignored that. He stepped around to the glass and wiped a bloody section clean. He peered inside, seeing very little of interest beyond the bloody paw prints marring the window. Then he saw the ceiling and the drooping grate, revealing a man-sized opening. "Get back," the vulture ordered, and his minions pulled away from the security bunker. Seeing what their leader was about to do, most took cover behind the scattering of vehicles or the corners of the booth. The vulture took aim at the glass, dead center, and fired. A dazzling line pummeled the surface, the light show winking out after contact. Those shots crackled back into the garage in other directions, causing the leather to duck. The glass remained intact. The vulture ceased firing, letting the weapon hang at arm's length. He sighed, then proceeded to shut the door where he took aim at the keypad. He didn't fire, however. After a few thoughtful seconds, he lowered the gun. Blowing out the device wouldn't help. It'd probably only make it more difficult to open. The vulture met the bronze's listless eyes. "Go in. If you find any more of these," he held up the sticks, "make use of them. Capture the girl. The others are disposable." Orders received, the bronze hefted his executioner's axe. The hammer hung from his belt. He nodded and lumbered forward, following the blood-spattered trail that led into Whitecap. The mindless had followed their prey's scent to the checkpoint, but then lost the trail. So they'd taken the only path into the compound in an attempt to pick up on it again. The vulture turned away from his menacing henchmen and studied the door once again. He then looked over at the carts. "See what works," the masked leader said to a lesser, gesturing at the vehicles. "Then go back and bring me Carson." 42. "Those guys," Gus said, watching the tall masked man with the battle axe strut towards a ramp, "are fucking assholes. Shitty-assed, skid-marked assholes." The chittering of Rogan's jaw picked up speed. Gus compared the progress of the mindless to that of the advancing killers with the medieval weaponry. His balls almost dropped off when he saw the one with the bird mask pick up the sticks. When the freak fired the weapon, Gus could only shake his head. "They've been on our ass ever since they tried killing us on a little island," he said.
"A little island?" Rogan repeated.
"A summer camp."
"Ah."
Gus waved a hand. "Don't you have, I don't know, guns or something, in case fuckheads get inside?"
"We do, but I couldn't access them."
Rogan shivered in his wheelchair. Gus watched him, knowing there was something seriously wrong. "You okay?" he finally asked. Rogan chuckled.
"I most certainly am not okay."
With the mechanical whirling of gears, the wheelchair rolled towards the light. Gus straightened. Rogan's face was a fluttering, twitching rictus of pain. His complexion was red as if he'd absorbed far too much sun, and pieces of his skin were peeling away like bark off a birch tree. His facial hair was non-existent, and his teeth, though fair, were the color of amber. Joshua Rogan certainly did not look okay. "Some changed," Gus remembered him saying. "You got a shot of T.I.?"
"I self-administered a shot of T.I., Rogan admitted, "and every other serum in its final testing stages. As I said, I was with the security team. Whitecap had been overrun. It was decided that I should inoculate myself just in case. I was the one who found patient zero, and that was after the fact, after Whitecap had fallen, and I was the only one left. I found out by watching recorded security feeds from the med lab. Sadly, that was after I'd taken the shot. Multiple shots. I'm afraid I was of the mind that more was better than less."
"Jesus Christ, Joshua," Gus whispered. The computers continued their chirping in the background. Rogan shrugged.
"It was a momentary lapse of reason brought on by panic. I've been changing slowly at first, but things seem to be progressing rapidly. I don't know what the final stage will be, but I don't think it will be flattering."
His jaw shook at that, and a raspy wheeze of a giggle left him.
But I do think I'm taking the change. Well,
Gus cringed.
You're going to have to wear more deodorant, Josh. This ain't working anymore.
Rogan appeared genuinely puzzled at that, before squeezing his eyes shut in understanding.
Pass me one of those, please.
Gus hesitated before doing as asked.
Thank you,
Rogan said. With trembling fingers, he popped the cover off and extended the stick.
You want to do that later? Gus asked.
He nodded at the monitors.
We got other things to do here.
Just wanted to show you,
Rogan said,
what I've been eating all this time.
And to Gus's horror, Rogan bit into the deodorant as if snacking on a chocolate bar. The research assistant chewed loudly, enjoying the mouthful. He sized up the stick before licking around the edges of his bite. That was a sight Gus knew he would remember in his dreams.
It's not, Rogan explained, as bad as you might think.
Gus shook his head.
Yeah.
I wasn't always like this, of course. It was just, cornflakes didn't do it for me anymore. I used this brand, and one morning, when I decided to put some on,
you decided to eat it.
A guilty-looking Rogan inspected the stick, and for a moment, Gus thought the man was going to lose it.
Yes,
the research assistant finally said with a surprising amount of control.
Yes, exactly that.
Why the sudden urge to eat deodorant, Josh? Gus asked.
I've pondered that myself. The smell drew me in. Smell is closely associated with taste, you know. Regardless, it's what I crave these days. What keeps me going, without question, a side effect of the multiple TI shots. The ample food provisions here, it no longer appealed to me, considering what I could be ingesting. I think this is acceptable.
Rogan looked at Gus.
I'm not a bad person, he explained. I saved you, after all, and I'll save your companions on condition.
Gus knew he wasn't going to like it. What's that?
I'll tell you later.
The research assistant smiled, then said,
I've exhausted the med lab's supply of chemicals trying to cure myself. Turns out, I'm not a very good scientist. This place is yours. It's perfectly safe. Any spore that might have been active has long dispersed and perished. We've established that it can't survive long in that form. If you wish, Whitecap and all within her is yours.
Gus stared at the sick man.
If you can repel the barbarians,
Rogan finished with a sick smile.
You got any weapons?
None.
Don't you have an armory or something?
Three, in fact, with a surplus of munitions, but I don't have the authorization.
Or the codes, Gus finished for him.
Or the codes, Rogan half shrugged. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm not that great a shot anyway. You have anything else? Pipes or heavy wrenches? Axes? Bats?
Rogan stiffened in his wheelchair.
Bats?
Bats, Gus asked with hope. You have any bats?
We have a batting cage in the LE section of the complex.
What's LE?
Leisure and entertainment.
Oh, okay. So you have bats there.
Aluminum ones.
It took Gus a second to absorb that. Where? He finally asked. 43.
Carson lay in the trunk of one of the cars. It was dark, and his legs hurt like unholy fuck. The leather had taken a hammer not only to his toes, but to his knees as well. He wasn't a doctor, but the way those 10 little piggies had popped apart, well, he figured the shivers he was feeling were from the onset of some serious infection. The worst day of his life was venturing out to Matheson by himself and getting caught by those masked cocksuckers. He should have killed himself before letting it happen.
The only thing worse than his current physical pain was the knowledge that he had doomed the rest of the islanders to an existence of servitude, or death, or worse. Carson wasn't a particularly pleasant man, nor was he particularly optimistic, but he tried to be fair. Thought things evened out on their own if he gave them time, though he didn't always have the patience to wait. This time, however, as his lower legs throbbed and a disturbing cold gripped his lower back, he didn't think things were going to even out. Not this time.
Sooner or later, they're gonna open this trunk,
he thought, before the hurt of his ruined legs tried to short-circuit his tortured brain. And when they did, he was going to claw for the nearest set of eyes or balls he could find. Just so they knew there would be no breaking him. Just so they'd kill him. And that would be the end of it. So when he heard what sounded like a muffled grunt immediately followed by cries of distress, Carson lifted his head and paid attention. A short scream of pain, then a crinkling of bone. Someone growled and huffed as if throwing a punch. The smack of bare fists and a curt grunt followed, then a startling slam of meat upon thin metal. Another scream, and that sound was snuffed out. Then nothing. Wires of light bled through the trunk seams, but not enough to see anything. Carson's eyes were wide, yet saw nothing. He heard plenty, however. A low, shambling step of someone moving around outside. The steps grew louder. Carson blinked, wondering what the hell was going on out there, and heard nothing more. Until a weight landed on the rear bumper of the car, causing the vehicle to sag.
Hey! Carson shouted. Hey!
The weight lifted from the rear bumper.
Hey, who's out there?
No answer. Nothing for the longest time, or so it seemed to the trapped man. Then the release of the lock. The trunk popped open, allowing precious light to enter, from nearby headlights, but light all the same. A shadow stood over him, blocking the glare, but what flared around the figure was blinding enough for the mechanic. He shielded his eyes and was so surprised that he'd forgotten his original plan.
You Carson?
A woman's voice. He peeked out from behind his hands.
Yeah.
Carson squinted, studied her from chin to chest, where his voice failed him. There was a bloody hole close to where her heart should be.
Well?
Collie asked.
You want out of that fucking trunk or not?
Some 20 minutes later, the EV returned with Carson in the back seat. The driver steered the machine straight on through, causing the leather inside the entry tunnel to jump out of the way. Heads turned as the EV drove by, slowing to a stop outside of the locked security room. The Vulture appreciated that kind of loyalty. The driver, wearing a bulky leather jacket and generic zipper mask, got out of the vehicle and with a grunt pulled Carson onto the floor. The leather dragged the mechanic by his arms to the Vulture. That it was a woman, no one cared. There were several in their ranks, equally as vicious as their male counterparts, or even more so. The Vulture ignored her as she propped up the crippled man against one leg.
Open this, the Vulture said to Carson, indicating the door's keypad.
His features contorted. Carson looked from the Vulture to the door.
I can't reach it, he seethed.
The driver manhandled the mechanic upright, but failed to get him any higher. A second leather stepped in, and together they got him onto his knees, which were broken, and Carson wailed upon impact. The Vulture sighed in frustration. He glanced around, looking for a chair before setting his sights on his last meat puppet.
Bring him here,
the leader ordered two of the leather. They brought Top Gun face to face with the Vulture.
Hands and knees, the Vulture instructed, and the two leather made certain the meat puppet obeyed.
The Vulture turned to Carson.
Sit on him.
The mechanic's pained face twisted into a question.
Sit,
the Vulture whispered, close to losing patience. He hefted the automatic sticks as a warning. Carson screamed as he was positioned on top of Top Gun's back. The leather who had fetched Carson from the trunk steadied him, then produced a straight-blade combat knife from her boot.
She placed the knife to Carson's ear, gripping the blade underhanded, as if about to pick away at a block of ice. No one gave the knife a second thought. In fact, the vulture approved of the gesture with a single nod. Carson's head hung low, very much aware of the blade at his ear. Sweat ran freely down his profile, and he lifted his gaze to consider the keypad.
"I can't open this," he said.
"Open it," the vulture said calmly.
"You need a code."
"Then break the code." Carson shook his head.
"I can't break the code. I'm just a mechanic."
Silence then, as the vulture stared at the back of the mechanic's head. "Then bypass it. Take the thing apart, or be blown apart." With that, the masked leader pointed the sticks at Carson's back. Carson fumed and fidgeted, while the female leather kept him on his human bench.
"I don't even have a fucking screwdriver, you moron,"
Carson rumbled. The female leather reached down with her free hand and grabbed the mechanic's wrist, keeping him in place with her other, with the blade now at his collar. She extended his hand to the keypad and flattened it against the lower edge of the console. The vulture watched her force him into position.
"If he doesn't do anything in the next 5 seconds, you may cut him."
The female leather didn't appear to hear him. Still holding onto Carson's wrist, she stepped out from behind him as he no longer needed her for balance. Her hand slid up the back of his and paused for only a second before she punched in a series of numbers on the keypad, the bright characters stretching across a digital display. A confused vulture looked at the female leather. In the same second, the security door slid open, whereupon the female leather spun and punched her knife through the vulture's neck. There was a choking spurt of blood, a reedy gasp of air, and even though the vulture wore a mask, there was no mistaking the surprise in the man's eyes. And in the split instant before his knees gave out, the driver grabbed the sticks, flipped it about, and unleashed a killer light show. 6 of the nearby leather were cut apart in an instant, their bloody torsos flung back by the unexpected burst. Collie dropped back to the doorway and lit up 3 more of the leather, blowing apart their heads in a startling display of tracer fire, rags, and brain matter. That drove the remainder of the pack to take cover. Collie released 2 more short bursts. Dozens of bullets flashed and crackled across the hide of one of the EVs in a charred line, the force of the blast shoving the vehicle a foot away. Carson fell with a yell, tumbling off the meat puppet who was still on his knees while screaming.
"Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus!"
Collie swung the weapon upon the puppet.
"I'm not with them,"
the man pleaded. She wavered, but only for a split second. Shadows were moving in the garage.
"Get him in there,"
she roared as she shot a leather popping up from behind a parked vehicle. The masked man flew backwards as if he'd been hit by rockets, his crossbow flying from his fingers. One of the leather swung his crossbow around the corner of the security booth and fired. The bolt grazed the material not a hair away from Collie's left ear. She blew her attacker's hands off at the wrist, and the man fell back, screaming. The freed meat puppet grabbed Carson by the shirt collar and fell into the booth. Collie followed, releasing another burst as she shuffled inside. She got 1 foot across the threshold when a crossbow bolt nailed her to the doorframe. The impact surprised her, stunned her even, and she released a grunt. The bolt had sunk into her chest, to the fletching. She slid down the wall just a bit, hearing the scree-scraw of a barbed head dragging over the booth's steel hide. There was no pain, just the brief disorientation of being knocked off balance. 2 leather rolled out from behind EVs, while a dozen more popped up from behind the vehicles where they'd taken cover. Collie lifted her battle rifle with 1 hand and blew away 1 figure before strafing right and shredding 2 more in shocking burps of meat and fabric. The remainder of the crossbowmen once again dove for cover. But those already on the floor took aim. 1 bolt took Collie in her knee, dropping her to the concrete. A 2nd bolt pierced her chest, breaking a rib and puncturing a lung right up to the shaft's flights. A 3rd bolt zapped her left shoulder, rocking her back. The remaining leather shouted. Carson and that human stool hauling him into the booth were screaming at her. Collie caught some movement through the wide pane of laminated glass. Shadows darted along the face of the booth, just barely visible through the sheet of gore. A leather wielding a medieval spear appeared around the corner, poised to stab.
Kali whipped up the battle rifle and drew an explosive line up the figure's center. Bloody firecrackers erupted from his back. "Get in here!" the human stool screamed at her. She tried to stand when a bolt nailed her right shoulder. She spun with the impact and took two more missiles to the chest, each one driving her against the doorframe. Another bolt missed her face by an inch, while two more bounced off the booth. Everything was becoming slippery. She attempted to lift the rifle, but her right arm refused to respond, and she knew in an instant it was as fucked up as her left. Two Leather popped up behind an EV, already aiming those jacked-up medieval needle spitters. Kali knew she couldn't get either one in time, so she slid her ass across the doorframe into empty space and let the impact of those two incoming bolts blast her backwards into the booth. She landed on her back.
"Jesus Christ!"
Carson screamed. Two leather-bound bastards holding, of all things, battle axes appeared in the open doorway. Kali couldn't lift her rifle up when she was standing, but now that she was flat on her back, she had no issue angling the gun upwards a few inches. She blasted the attackers, cutting both across the knees, causing them to collapse and grab for stumps that gushed scarlet.
"Hit that button!"
she shouted. The manstool launched himself at the door controls. He hit the red button. The door slid shut, just as the shadows outside converged upon the closing portal. They didn't make it. The booth was once again secured. His hands shaking, the manstool pulled off his mask, revealing a lightly bearded face that had completely shit itself of all color. Someone smashed a club against the laminated glass, and all three of them flinched. Kali pulled herself to a sitting position.
"I'm getting fucking tired of these nutsacks."
She discarded the sticks and crawled toward Carson, who wormed his way out of her path. She flicked a switch on one of the computer terminals and hauled a wheeled office chair over to sit on. She collapsed onto the furniture with a gasp. A considerable amount of blood spattered the white floor as she leaned over a keyboard. The monitor demanded security clearance.
"Authorization,"
Kali seethed in a furious voice.
"You want a code?"
Her fingers nimbly punched in a series of characters. The monitor flashed red, and next to the terminal, a plastic cover popped up, revealing a second red button, one specially made to withstand a heavy impact. A klaxon bared to life overhead, warning all individuals to move their asses. The remaining leather surrounding the booth glanced up at the mechanical sound.
"Here's a fucking code for you,"
Kali said. She hammered the waiting button with the ball of her fist. The world outside the booth erupted into cleansing flame for a full 10 seconds. The figures battering the glass fell away as if the floor had been yanked out from under them. There was no screaming from beyond, only that muted roar of fire jetting from unseen vents above and below.
"Decontamination box,"
Kali wearily explained to the two men staring.
"Of course, the doors are usually closed when this happens. And I skipped hosing them down with heavy sanitizer. Figured a shot of the red and heavy was better.
Thoughts?" Carson didn't reply. The human stool beside him didn't say a word either.
"Good," Kali said.
She eyed one, then the other, and then noticed the crossbow bolts sticking out of her body. She inspected the flights and focused on the human stool.
"You're one of the slaves?"
she asked.
"Yeah," he said, rubbing his eyes. "You gonna give me a hard time?"
The man met her eyes. The sticks was on the floor, within easy reach if he wanted it. There were even a few rounds remaining.
"Not me," he muttered in pure mental exhaustion.
The flames continued washing the window and the parking garage outside.
"Thought so,"
Kali muttered, and went back to watching the fire. 44. Gus hurried along a concrete hallway, a hidden passage that linked several of the underground amenities in the commercial sector. A single rail of light overhead lit the way, illuminating a bare concrete floor and walls. Every 15 feet or so, the ceiling light winked on as he raced along. Rogan would be watching where he could, the assistant explained, but the back passages didn't have the same extensive surveillance system in place. He also mentioned that his memory was failing him. He promised Gus to do everything in his power to help him repel the barbarians, as the assistant kept referring to them, but for the most part, Gus was on his own. Which was fine, Gus figured. He'd been too damn reliant on Kali anyway. Too quick to follow. Not that Kali was a bad person to follow, she was the best. But now, she was gone. And Gus realized he had to start thinking for himself rather than wait for orders. The thought of her made his heart ache and his throat clutched until it hurt. Unable to wipe at his eyes because of his helmet's visor, Gus blinked away the sadness. Kali would not approve. The lit floor below him stretched out ahead about a dozen paces. Gus felt like he was chasing a moving void that was always just out of reach. Rogan told Gus not to worry about his own safety. There were only two ways into the security command center. One was the secret elevator that Gus had used. The other was through a series of stairwells that linked the many levels of the bunker. And when Gus left him, two steel doors closed, sealing the assistant within Whitecap's inner keep. The lighting ahead exposed a stairwell stamped with the block letters A7 on the wall. He hurried down the seven flights of stairs all the way to ground level, and by the time he reached A1, his legs were aching dearly. His treacherous foot was in full revolt, and the other one wasn't too happy either. Gus hung off the steel railing, his shoulders lurching, and stood at an intersection. The steps continued below, and if he leaned out over the railing, he could just make out B1. Those steps would take him deeper underground, under the ground entrance, and he could only guess at what was kept down there. He studied the three wide passageways open before him. The C area corridor was to the right of the stairwell. That would take him back to the underground paradise he'd walked through earlier, except this time he would be backstage in the authorized personnel-only sections. Barbarians, he thought. Forcing himself into a jog, Gus left the stairwell behind and forged ahead, the lights flicking on as he labored along, puffing like a steam engine. Black double doors passed by, leading to the shopping sector and woodlands he'd seen on the other side. Across from each set of doors was a techie-looking area filled with computer terminals, filing cabinets, and doors leading to, presumably, additional storage areas. A single sliding door with a keypad granted access to those rooms, but a couple were opened. Gus rushed by them all.
Where the hell's one of them goddamn buggies? He rasped, slowing to a forced march and grimacing with every step.
The helmet and body armor weren't as heavy or claustrophobic as his firefighter's gear, but it was every bit as hot. Hotter since he was inside the temperature-controlled innards of a mountain fortress. Whatever thin layers of body fat he might have stored over the winter were quickly melting. Doors came and went. Some spaced apart only a few meters, others more than 30. He was getting close now, very close. Rogan said he would have to go back the way he traveled, then follow the lit hallways until he reached the batting cages.
Rogan. Poor bastard.
All alone this whole time, living in what was essentially a giant grave, bound to a wheelchair and munching on, of all things, deodorant sticks. That made Gus stop in his tracks.
Well, shit, he thought.
When he put it that way, how could the guy not be just a little insane?
I'm not a bad person, the assistant had said. I saved you, after all, and I'll save your companions.
Gus walked on a few more steps and faced the doorway marked batting cages. There were two bolt locks on his side, both unlocked, and when Gus tried turning the first knob, it didn't move. A second later, there was an audible click. And the door opened.
I'll be watching where I can, Rogan had also said just before Gus left him.
Whatever surveillance cameras the bunker had were expertly hidden. Gus didn't see anything that resembled a black overturned snow cone. He turned the doorknob and cautiously stuck his head inside. Two lonely lights barely lit up six cages, six distinct lanes divided by netting. Gus realized he was at the rear of the batting area, opposite where the balls would be belted. Three pitching machines were aimed at their respective home plates, one of which was located about 10 feet away from him, standing like a silent sentinel cannon. Another three machines were parked in a distant corner to Gus's left. An artificial turf covered the floor, and lawn chairs were just visible at the other end, providing onlookers a place to perch while they waited their turn. Or whatever. Gus couldn't give a fuck about the particulars. He wanted the goods, and he saw them. Mounted on a gray wall on the left side of the batting area. The bats stood tall and proud and beckoned him like Olympic torches. Most were colored, from bright orange to glow-in-the-dark green. Gus then saw the clear glass, which ran the length of the room right behind where the spectators' chairs were set up. "Why, Lord?" God whispered at the ceiling. "Why do you save my ass only to kick it back into the shitter, time after time? I mean, fuck." Keeping abreast of the netting and the shadows, Gus discovered his second wind as he walked past the individual batting lanes. Halfway through, he discovered the middle lane wasn't enclosed at all, and actually led to the front of the batting area. He turned the corner, eyes on the glass wall, and eventually reached the bat rack. Wood and alloy bats were firm to the touch. Numbers flitted by, designating weight of each bat. He stopped at a plain gray aluminum slugger with the number 8 above it. The plainness of that length of metal, soon to be a head splitter, attracted him. Gus took the bat and held it samurai style. It was a good weight, just under 2 pounds, yet powerful, and ready to smash. "Sorry, Woodies," he muttered to the others. "I found Miss Wright." A light flickered on outside the cages from the main walkway, and a shadow raced up to the glass. A floppy hand, boneless from the wrist up, smashed against the clear partition and sent oily rivulets shooting in all directions. The thing pressed its face against the surface, flattening a cheek and stretching the skin around a milky eyeball. An eyeball that slowly split open from the pressure. Gus grimaced at the sight. His grimace deepened as more undead, he discovered he had a problem with thinking of these things as alive, caught up and joined the first one at the window. He didn't know how they'd tracked him through what he suspected should have been an airtight bunker. Maybe the smell afflicting him got sucked up into an air duct or something. In any case, they'd found him. The rest of the pack charged right up to the window and crashed into it like the mindless monsters they were. No more than 3 dozen of the creatures. Gus held his bat across his pelvis and glowered at the hateful things. Then he remembered where he was and what was with him. He retreated, keeping to the shadows, and stopped in a corner with the discarded pitching machines. He studied the black mesh enclosing each designated batting lane. The mesh extended upwards, where it was suspended in an intricate lattice consisting of more rope and support rods hanging from the ceiling. It was the finest netting Gus had ever seen in his life. He approached the midway point and rested for all of 10 seconds while his plan took form. All the while, the mindless tracked him, pounding upon the glass. He would have to work fast, very fast. And even then, he'd have to kill them as if he were in a supercharged game of whack-a-mole, because they would be pissed, super pissed, and flailing, maybe even desperate. Excitement began to build as Gus walked up the center lane partitioning the 6 batting cages, 3 on either side, towards the main entrance. This would be close. So very close. He eyed the door controls. There were 2 buttons, clearly marked, along with a 3rd one labeled lock. The zombies moved toward the entrance, ready to intercept. They were shifting, pawing, piling onto one another, a terrifying multi-legged amoeba of flesh and bone. Eyes watched him, teeth snapped, fingers dragged over the surface of the glass, some bursting under the extreme pressure. More faces pressed up against the glass, which was becoming a nightmarish smear of skin and blood. "Careful what you wish for, bitches." Gus hefted the bat and tapped the door control. The portal swung inward. The scrum of zombies fell forward in a gush, landing in a noisy, howling sprawl. The ones pushing from behind fell over them as they, in turn, were shoved from behind. Gus didn't wait for them to rise. He was already at the end of the middle lane and turning right, back towards the corner filled with pitching machines, bypassing and staying clear of all those fine batting meshes just hanging in the wind. The first few zombies to stand charged forward, heedless of Gus's more precise route, and charged after him at an angle, going through the netting. The first lane collapsed with an alarming crackle, the mesh falling over at least 4 gimps. That cleared the way for the rest, but even as the others charged forward, their feet became entangled. One runner avoided the trap few until a zombie caught under the mesh attempted to rise, pulling the net backwards, which yanked the charging zombie off his feet and onto his face. That ugly spill tripped up 2 more right behind him, and they went down in a savage heap. Gus backed himself into the corner and watched the mayhem. Mindless raved and trudged over the netting, stomping over the ones trapped underneath. That heaving mess slowed them until they reached the second batting lane. They trundled forward, their fingers stabbing through the mesh. More than a few digits were bowed backward until snapping. The mindless lurched into the netting, and the combined weight pulled the support lattice down from the ceiling with a clatter. More zombies were entangled until the whole floor resembled a spidery oil spill. Those still trying to rise hampered the charge of those free until ultimately they all went down, which opened the way for the last of them, and those that got past their struggling companions ran face first into the netting of the third batting lane, yanking a final layer of mesh from the ceiling. The whole area became a thrashing, seething marsh of rising and falling bodies, becoming increasingly entangled with every passing second. In every instance where one zombie attempted to stand, the surrounding chaos pulled the thing back down. It was glorious. Gus waited until the foremost of the mindless got within range, a man with the netting pulled tight over his head and screaming through a mouthful of mesh. Gus broke open his skull with one swing, that unsettling crack of metal on bone serving as a starting pistol. When the creature went down, Gus retreated to the bat rack, while the entire floor attempted to follow him. They could not. It was a chaotic, lilting tug of war, with no unity beyond being ensnared in the net. Zombies would stand, only to be yanked off their feet when others trapped underneath a section would rise. Those covered in mesh would inadvertently drag the net over others. All the while, the lattice of rods and ceiling hooks, pulled down by the mindless, became an anchor, slowing the undead even more. Gus picked his second target and bashed in its skull. He killed a third, then a fourth, avoiding stepping onto the net itself. Plenty of zombies remained.
"Fuck me," Gus muttered, realizing just how many were after him. The sight of all those trapped gimps deflated his initial elation of a successful plan. It was going to take time to slaughter them all, and energy. "Thanks, Lord," he mentally projected. Taking a deep breath, he smashed the next head.
45. Roughly 36 of the leather followed the trail of the mindless. Blood streaked the walls in gruesome barcodes, while thick spatters of gore coated the floor. It was as if a bleeding mob had squeezed their collective asses through a narrow passage. As the leather delved deeper into the bunker's hidden realms, overhead lights automatically switched on. The bronze strode behind the advancing leather, surrounded by a handful of minions. His mask barely acknowledged the artificial splendor of the bunker's indoor beach or shimmering night sky. He didn't care for the shop facades or the numerous sport and entertainment attractions. He wanted the prize for the dog tongue. The bronze gripped his executioner's axe in one fist. Somewhere in this subterranean maze was a little girl. The little girl was important, very important to the leather's plans of expansion. The bunker, however, had the potential to be even more so. There were weapons to be found. He could smell it. But before the leather could devote time to finding those weapons, he had to contend with the task at hand. So they followed their unleashed hounds, keeping just enough distance from the mob, and let the mindless do the thing they did best. Find the meat. The entrances leading to the bunker's amenities were locked, and one of the leather with a bat actually clubbed the glass. To no effect. The bronze barked at the minion in a rare display of anger. They needed to employ stealth, not brute force. There was no need to smash anything. Not on this particular hunt. Something caught the bronze's attention, however. The place was clean. Despite the deluge of bodies leading up and into the bunker, this section was cleared of the dead, which puzzled him. The lights continued to switch on for the leather as they strode past elaborate sets resembling beachfronts draped in shadow.
Shops, the bronze noted. So many shops. As if the living believed reconstructing the old world would have any benefit. The old world was gone, forever. Those who believed otherwise were either dying or already dead.
The leather ahead stopped and gathered before a shoe shop. The bronze saw why. One of those small golf carts had been jammed through the glass front. Glass pebbles covered the floor. Displays had been either flipped or pushed aside, as if a tank had rolled through the aisle, bursting it completely. Toppled boxes spilled sneakers and packing paper onto the floor, leaving a trail to the rear of the shop. The bronze signaled for his minions to wait while he studied the scene. After a moment, he crawled over the cart and stood within the shop. No lights came on, so the executioner readied his axe and headed inside. The bronze took two steps and paused, cocking his head, listening. Nothing sprang at him from the dark. No one challenged him. He explored further, pushing through the clutter, dislodging a few boxes as he went. The trail ended in a back room, where another surprise waited. The overhead light came on as he entered, revealing an open doorway filled with four